You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Jake Jacobson. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, May 19th, 2021.
Later in the program, I spoke with Pat East, Executive Director for the Dimension Mill here in Bloomington. We discussed the work he does for the mill and also touched on an award the city received for being a rising tech city from TechPoint, a resource for Indiana's technology industry. More coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have the latest edition of Civic Conversations, a monthly podcast collaboration between the League of Women Voters of Bloomington and Monroe County and WFHB. But first, your local news brief.
Monroe County has seen a 60% decrease in reported COVID-19 cases within the last 14 days. A majority of the decrease is directly correlated with vaccinations, according to the CDC. Although vaccinated citizens are not encouraged to wear masks anymore, the CDC still highly encourages those who have not been vaccinated to continue social distancing, wearing masks, and to schedule their COVID-19 vaccine as soon as possible through their website, www.cdc.gov. In order to encourage vaccinations, Joe Biden announced that Uber and Lyft will provide free rides to vaccination sites until July 4th. Also, just yesterday, abortion rights groups asked a federal judge on Tuesday to block a new Indiana law signed by Governor Eric Holcomb that would require doctors to tell women undergoing drug-induced abortions about an unproven treatment for reversing the abortion. A lawsuit has been filed with the U.S. District Court in Indianapolis that argues that the requirements would harm patients and break a doctor's code of ethics.
At the May 18th Monroe County Community School Corporation board meeting, board member Kathy Fuentes Roer presented several policies regarding weapons to the board for second reading. She explained the policies would no longer let resource officers carry firearms on school property.
At the last board meeting, the board asked to be provided policies for second and final reading that would eliminate carry permissions for our school resource officers while on school property. In addition, the board expects that when Dr. Housewald begins his position this summer, we will continue this conversation about student safety, discipline policies, and the social-emotional health of our students as we set our board goals and priorities with him.
Board member Martha Street moved to delay the vote. She suggested the board make this decision alongside their new superintendent. Street's motion did not receive a second. Board member April Hennessy spoke to the importance of supporting these policies. She said MCCSC needs to show that schools are safe without using firearms.
Part of why I feel really strongly about this policy. You know, rather than fear, I hope, and I have always hoped since my time in the district, that we will front load our schools with the language of expectation and possibility. And if we say that schools are safe, then we have to lean into that. And using the language or the tactics of the carceral system just inherently contradict that assertion and that presumption.
Board members voted to pass these policies 6-1, with board member Street voting nay.
For today's feature report, I spoke with Pat East, Executive Director for the Dimension Mill here in Bloomington. We discussed the work he does for the mill and also touched on an award the city received for being a rising tech city from TechPoint, a resource for Indiana's technology industry. Hello, today I'm speaking with Pat East, Executive Director for The Mill here in Bloomington, Indiana. Pat, welcome to the WFHB Local News.
Thanks for having me, Benny.
Thank you so much. Tell me a little bit about What role have you played in growing new businesses here in Bloomington?
Well, obviously, in my current role as executive director of the mill, I play a big role in helping businesses get started, helping them grow, helping them accelerate. We have a ton of programming related to entrepreneurship and just understanding how to build a company. Previously, I ran a company called Hennepin Marketing that I co-founded with my wife. I was CEO for 16 years before we sold that. And then I'm also an angel investor and mentor to startups as well. So really kind of those three roles are what I've done in Bloomington in terms of helping startups.
Well, it sounds like you're just the guy to be running the mill over there as the executive director. In your own words, could you tell me a little bit about what is the mill?
So for folks who don't know the mill, what we always say is the mill is 19,000 square feet of co-working and incubator space. It's a pretty apt description because that's exactly what it is. What that means, though, is that we want to be the epicenter of everything entrepreneurship and startup in Bloomington. And so if you are thinking about starting a company, we want you to eventually come here. If you're thinking about growing your company, accelerating, we want you to be here. Anything that has to do with company building and startups and investment and anything in that arena, whether it's innovation or technology, we ultimately want to be the epicenter for all of that. So on its face, functionally, we're 19,000 square feet of co-working and incubator space, but ultimately the role we want to play within our community is to launch and accelerate companies, and we want to be one stop along the way for anybody and everybody.
Wow, that's really impressive. And for anyone that's been down to the mill, I feel as if they're equally impressed. It sounds like a very Silicon Valley or otherwise New York City type of place. Tell me, why did Bloomington need a space like the mill?
Yeah, so Bloomington needed a space like the mill for a few reasons. One is that this is a physical, tangible way of saying, here's how we support entrepreneurship. So people can literally look at the building and say, awesome, this is how the city invests. The second is that our entrepreneurs were kind of splintered, meaning everybody was off doing their own thing. Some of us knew about the others, but there really wasn't enough daily density to generate momentum and build an ecosystem. So daily density would mean like, hey, we're running into each other all the time. There really wasn't enough momentum where 1 + 1 could equal 3. You know, at one point we had 3 Internet of Things companies, so very specialized startup companies, and 2 of them didn't even know about the other. And so that's really kind of how splintered we were. And so, you know, the mill came along at really kind of the perfect time for pulling everybody together and also showing people, here's how Bloomington supports its entrepreneurs.
That's a really fantastic resource to have here in town. And if you could depict for me, what does a day look like, an average day look like at the mill where people are colliding and sharing ideas and working and doing their own thing?
Yeah, so a typical day is there's a lot of energy and activity here. That's kind of the theme from day to day. But on any given day, a portion of our 300 members are here, and they range from startups to freelancers to corporate employees to consultants. They're taking meetings. They're in our call booths. They're in our conference rooms. They're in the cafe. They're in one of the lounge areas. They're making connections with other members. They may bring guests in to meet with them. They might be doing their normal work, right? Their normal computer or laptop work, but they're doing it from a remote setting. And of course, pre-pandemic, we had a lot of events here. So we'd have an event probably every day or every other day, just about. And so pre-pandemic, a lot of our members would attend those events in the event hall and the classroom.
That sounds like a really momentum building type of environment to be in. And being a group of people who use words like pivot and innovate and being in there doing that each day, how did all of you pivot during this pandemic?
You know, so we had to pivot quite a bit during the pandemic. At the very beginning, so call it mid-March, we shifted to virtual programming. What we quickly realized, along with the rest of the world, was that people were zoomed out. And so we stopped doing a lot of that programming, and we focused on the areas where we could make progress towards our mission of launching and accelerating startups that didn't require face-to-face interaction. So we started a handful of programs. One was Flywheel Fund. We started that in August with 10 investors writing $25,000 checks as a group. That went extraordinarily well, so we doubled down on that in April, just last month, with 50 investors writing $50,000 checks as a group. So that's gone extraordinarily well, created a lot more startup investors and created another capital source for our startups. Code School was another pivot for us. So that came directly from the desire to create a short-term stimulus for the economy that also achieved a long-term goal, which is developing more programmers. The world has about a million unfilled programming positions. And so the more programmers we can create, the better. And so we started a Code School program, and we focus on training the unemployed and underemployed. In the fall, we expanded Crossroads, which is our statewide pitch competition, with more judges, more startups, more sponsors, more prizes. And then in the spring, we launched Crossroads Collegiate, which is our statewide pitch competition, but exclusively for colleges and universities. So we had 15 different startups from colleges and universities and campuses all over Indiana participate. And also in the spring, we launched Reboot, which is our pre-accelerator for the formerly incarcerated. So pulling in these marginalized folks in society and kind of not just including them, but opening up the door and making sure they're included and helping them launch and start businesses. So those are all, you know, myriad of different ways that we pivoted during the pandemic. And they've all turned out extraordinarily well.
That is a very, that's an intense amount of activity. It sounds like the pandemic encouraged you to do even more, and true to the name of being innovators, you all have filled that role and performed those changes.
Yes, the team is extraordinarily smart and extraordinarily hardworking. And so, you know, the great thing about working during a pandemic, particularly working at home, is you can be much more productive because you don't have a lot of those micro interruptions. And so they put down their heads and they got to work, and we created a ton of programming that we feel creates a lot of value for our members and for the community at large, and also generates revenue for us too, so we can continue working towards our goal of becoming self-sustainable.
That's really great to hear. I wanted to take a quick step and step back and ask a question about the Flywheel Fund, which I heard you mentioned as one of your recent initiatives. You know, one of the common criticisms of being in a small, undersized, you would say, city like this that's attempting to do tech-related things is funding. And so I heard you say that you had 50 investors writing $50,000 checks. Where do those investors come from?
So all of those investors are from Indiana. Majority, two-thirds, are about from Bloomington. And so these are generally folks with business backgrounds. So they're CEOs, they're presidents, they're vice presidents. We have a few professors from IU Kelly. We have a few retired folks, retired executives. We have a handful of startup CEOs themselves that are also investing. But they're all from, a majority are from Bloomington. Of the 50, about two-thirds are from Bloomington. And kind of as a group, we pooled all of our money together and we're writing 50K checks as a group. And so it really creates a nice pool of capital for our startups, but also creates more startup investors. You know, all these folks existed previously, but they were putting their money into other assets, into other asset classes like real estate. And really, they just needed to be presented with a clear path to figure out how to startup invest. And once they were presented with that clear path, a lot of folks signed up really quickly.
And I imagine that there are a lot of other advantages that are leveraged by having that close community connection also for the startup founder.
one of the things that has become a very real and tangible competitive advantage for us as a fund competing against other people who want to invest in these same startups is that we have 50 potential mentors that have a background in 50 different industries that have different perspectives and come from different walks of life. And so so for sure, there's at least one mentor out of our 50 that is going to be able to give you some really good perspective on your business and meet with you on a regular basis. And so that's been something that has really been attractive to startups who pitch us, being able to access all of that intelligence and those experiences.
That's great. Being a person who is formerly on a startup journey, I know how valuable that can be. So the mill being there in that way and designing these programs with that uniqueness is really great to hear. This is part one of a two-part series. Part two will air tomorrow during the local news.
Up next, we have the latest edition of Civic Conversations, a monthly podcast from the League of Women Voters of Bloomington and Monroe County. In today's show, host Jim Allison speaks with James Madison, author of The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland and history professor at Indiana University. Host Jim Allison has more.
This is Civic Conversations, a podcast collaboration between the League of Women Voters, Bloomington Monroe County, and WFHB. And I'm Jim Allison, your host. Becky Hill is our producer. We're very pleased to say that you can find Civic Conversations every month on WFHB at 93.1 and 98.1 FM. Today, we welcome James Madison, author of The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, who is Emeritus Professor, Department of History, Indiana University. Jim, thanks for being here today.
Delighted. Thank you, Jim.
Now, Professor Madison, before we start talking about your book, it's hard as the dickens to write a book. Why do you keep doing it?
Well, before I answer that, let me just give a shout out to the League of Women Voters, formed at about the same time the Ku Klux Klan was, in an ironic kind of way, but an organization that sure does a heck of a lot of good, important work compared to most of the works that the Klan did. Well, why do I write books? Well, I guess I'm kind of a history nerd, and I can't get over it. I've been doing this for 50 years or so. More seriously, I enjoy it. I don't have too many other hobbies or sins. And I guess even more seriously, I see as I age, especially, the connections between past and present, which I think are one of the fundamental essentials of citizenship and democracy.
Understood. Why don't you tell us about the research that you did for your book on the Klan? And while you're at it, why don't you tell us what your biggest surprise was there in your research?
Okay, well, I could talk about the research for a long time. I spent 3 years focused on this book and lots of time before that thinking about the subject. Historians deal in primary sources. There are gold. That is, the actual voices, the documents, the records of the people of the time. So I spent lots and lots of time reading, for example, the weekly newspaper of the Ku Klux Klan, published in Indianapolis. Lots of time reading letters and other documents. That is the essential part of research for a scholar, for a historian. We don't deal in opinion or myth, though those are fascinating. So that was really the basis of my research. And I'm blessed that we have great sources in Indiana for the Klan, great libraries. The Indiana Historical Society Library was the principal one for me, but many others as well. And then finally, I guess, thanks to good librarians and other people, we have digitization of these collections of newspapers, documents, including the Indianapolis Fiery Cross. Anyone can go out and read it anytime on your desktop. So the primary sources are really the basic part of my research. I read most of the stuff by other scholars about the Klan, but that's the important thing. As to the surprise, well, there were several surprises, Jim. One was I came after 3 years immersed in this to actually take the people who joined the Klan seriously. I think they had genuine beliefs in what they were doing, as shocking as that is today. I also was surprised by the extent and depth of their power. The Klan was very powerful in Indiana. And it was powerful for many reasons, because lots of white native-born Protestant Hoosiers believed in their ideals and their purpose and their mission, but also because the Klan, they were not a bunch of kooks, of outliers. They were very sophisticated in building an organization, in building social and religious and cultural power, and in building political power. So those are the things that really impressed me most as I worked on this book. And then again, the connections between past and present. The past never really repeats itself, but as someone said, it does sort of rhyme. And lots of readers of this book have told me or asked questions about the connections between past and present. And I do in the last chapter get down to those connections. I write about Governor Mike Pence. I write about the events in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, and related events that do have connections to the Klan in the 1920s.
Okay, I was about to ask you to describe the earliest Klan members. You've done a little bit of that already. We have a better idea of what they were like, I think, from what you've just said. So let's dig in a little more detail into 20th century Indiana. And I'm going to ask you to talk, of course, about Grand Dragon D.C. Stevenson and his downfall.
Yeah.
What can you say? Tell us about him.
Sure. Stevenson is probably the most well-known Klan member, Klan leader in Indiana, and really in America in the 1920s. He had a national reputation. He was very talented, very charismatic, very, very smart at building this organization from the grassroots all the way to the state capital and to the nation's capital. But Stevenson was also one of the most evil men who ever walked the soil of Indiana. And he was eventually caught and convicted for only part of his crimes, convicted and sent to jail for the rape and murder of a young woman named Madge Oberholzer. It's a very important story, full of all sorts of meaning. However, the spotlight on Stevenson and his crimes obscures and puts in the shadows the really important stories, far more important, I believe, and I argue, than the story of Stevenson and his leadership, the stories of ordinary Hoosiers. Good Hoosiers, they thought of themselves as good Hoosiers, who joined this organization, which we now think of as a hate group. I'm not sure that's accurate or fair even. But those people, their minds, their actions, values, beliefs, that's where the real story is, I believe.
Okay, I was here in Bloomington in the 1960s when the Klan was involved in some famous activities. What can you tell us about the Klan in Bloomington in the 1960s and today, for that matter?
I was here too, Jim, and you may remember, as I do vividly, the tragedy of the bombing of the Black Market on Kirkwood
on
Christmas Eve, 1969.
I do.
By Klan members. And it was a deep shock to all of us, especially at the university, because this was a way in which African-American students were really moving forward to express their political and cultural values and views at a time where that was very controversial, even in universities. And here these idiots come along and firebomb it. Maybe the good news there in part is that is now, as many people know, People's Park, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. And there's an official state historical marker there. So walk by that beautiful spot and read that marker and understand what happened in good old Bloomington, Indiana, when the Klan came. They claim it came at other times, of course. By this time, however, one very serious point is that for the 1960s and after, the Klan that came back in Indiana was a little tiny remnant of what it was in the 1960s. And these weren't good people. These weren't normal mainstream Hoosiers. These were, frankly, mostly whack jobs. They were absurd, driven above all by white racism, unlike the Klan of the 1920s, which had other more important issues, actually. So, yeah, it came back. And, you know, the Klan is still around today. There are remnants of it. They pop up every once in a while, I'm sure.
Okay, let me ask you, how does the Heartland Klan differ, if it does differ, from the Deep South Klan?
Well, the Klan in the South, from the first Klan after the Civil War down to the present, has been driven mostly by white supremacy and by fear and hatred of African Americans. That's not true of the Klan in Indiana in the 1920s. The biggest enemy by far of the Indiana Klan in the 1920s were Catholics. That's hard to understand, and we don't have time for me to explain it. You have to take my word for it or read the book. But anti-Catholicism was deep in Protestant America in the 1920s, and that drove the Klan. There was anti-Semitism, there was anti-Black, of course, but it was anti-Catholicism and anti-immigration, actually, that really drove the Klan in Indiana in the 20s.
And they didn't exactly invent that, did they?
They didn't invent that. Boy, that was invented long ago, that anti-Catholic stuff. And it came over in the ships with the first settlers. They brought those first Euro-Americans brought all sorts of good things with them, and then all sorts of other kinds of things with them.
Didn't they, though? Yeah. Well, do you think the Klan in its heyday exemplified what we call today identity politics, which is, I guess,
in some ways, we didn't call it that in the 20s, but in some ways, it certainly was a kind of tribal group. It was, and this is the way I try to explain it in the book, it was really us and them, we, the good people, us, them, all those who are not like us. And for the Klan, they worked very hard to market that idea, and they did it brilliantly by this label of 100% American. They used it all the time. We are 100% Americans because we are white, native-born, and Protestant. 100%, and you are not. And you never will be, most of you, you Catholics, you immigrants, you Jews, you African-Americans.
Okay, so I would submit
that that's one of the most dangerous ideas in all of American history.
Okay, does it have a close equivalent today, would you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's all around us today. Not expressed exactly in the same words. Sometimes it's the same words. But let's be blunt here. The former president, the former guy, now hiding out in Mar-a-Lago, was full of us and them kind of talk, full of 100% American kind of talk. And apparently there are millions of Americans today who sadly believe that some of us are better than others of us. And that it's on the basis of take your pick, but often on the basis of race, that white people are better than people of color. That is an idea that I might have thought in 1969, Jim, when we were young, that was an idea that was passing. But one of the saddest things for me is to see that come back in recent years with a vengeance.
Okay, Jim, let me see if I can get you to do some speculation here. Why have such organizations found such fertile ground in our American democracy?
Well, that's a tough one. But I think it's in part because we have these wonderful ideals in America, the kind of ideals that the League of Women Voters supports and pushes. But they're hard to understand. They're hard to live up to on the street, on an operational level. We disagree. For example, take the issue of white privilege. I'm not going to insist that everyone agree that white folks have privilege. I think we do. But I would like us all to have a more thoughtful conversation about the possibilities that white privilege actually operates in our country and what it means for our ideals. That's a tough thing, it seems today, for Americans to do.
Well, thank you very much, Jim Addison, for joining us today on Civic Conversations. And thank you to our listening audience for listening to us today. This is Jim Allison of League of Women Voters, Bloomington, Monroe County. The League is a nonpartisan grassroots organization led by citizens that's fought since 1920 to improve our government and engage all citizens in the decisions that impact their lives. Join us in June when we talk about climate change in Indiana with Melissa Widhelm, Purdue University Climate Change Research Center.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Katherine Patterson and Jake Jacobson in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Civic Conversations is produced by Jim Allison.
Our feature was produced by Benedict Jones. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young.
Stay tuned for an episode from A Sense of Place in light of Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. That's coming up next on WFHB.